today we're examining the case of the Lake Worth Monster, a creature reported in 1969 near Fort Worth. What began as a series of eyewitness accounts quickly expanded into widespread media coverage, public reaction, and over time, a lasting piece of regional folklore. In this episode, we're focusing on the available records, early reports, witness descriptions, law enforcement responses, and how the story developed through newspapers, books, and later media. We'll also look at how explanations, including hoaxes and misidentifications, shaped the narrative alongside firsthand accounts. We will present what was reported and how it was documented and how it evolved. We'd like to welcome you in to the Ominous Archives. Hello, Archive members, and welcome back. As always, I'm Nick.
And I'm Em.
And today I have a good one for you. For both of you, Em, and whoever else may be listening.
I love when you say that like I haven't already read the notes.
You haven't read the notes.
I haven't not read the notes.
Perfect. Then you're going to love this. Okay, so today we're going to be heading down to the great state of Texas.
Big state. Lots of things I'm sure you could be scared of out there.
More than you'd probably think. We're going specifically to Fort Worth, or kind of just outside of it, actually. There's a reservoir called Lake Worth. It sits right to the northwest of the city, and in the summer of 1969, something started showing up around it. Something that, to this day, nobody has really been able to fully explain.
All right, I'm intrigued. What kind of something are we talking here?
Well, that's actually a great place to start because, and this is one of my favorite things about this case, nobody can really quite agree on what it looks like.
Okay, well, that's not a great sign for the witnesses.
No, it's not. But hear me out. Because there are enough overlapping details that it gets interesting. So across multiple reports from multiple different people who didn't know each other, you get this consistent image of a large, upright figure. We're talking about 7 or 8 feet tall. Several hundred pounds, walking on two legs, not on all fours.
Okay, so immediately humanoid, that's already unsettling enough.
Right. It moves like a person, but it's very much not a person. Or, well, that's kind of debatable. We'll get to that later.
What the heck does that mean?
Breathe. Physically, here's where it gets weird. Some witnesses said it was covered in long, shaggy fur, like an animal. Others said it had rough, scaly skin, like a reptile.
So those are two extremely different descriptions here.
They are. And some people reported both, like fur and scales on the same creature.
So either everyone was seeing something different, or this thing looked like it just couldn't decide what it wanted to be.
Exactly. And the lighting out there at night, it's not very great. So you could argue people were interpreting the same texture differently, but still, not a reassuring level of consistency.
Okay, well, what about the face?
Several witnesses described it as goat-like. So we're kind of back to like the Popolec monster style.
Okay.
It's animalistic. Some mentioned horns. Not everybody, but enough people have mentioned it that it comes up. And then there's one guy, Jim Steffens, who said the figure looked large and human-like, but had what appeared to be burn marks or scarring across the face, arms, and chest.
Well, that sounds horrible.
Right? The detail doesn't show up in many accounts, but it kind of stuck with me. Like, imagine seeing that kind of thing come out of the dark.
It's actually the exact last thing I would like to imagine coming out of the dark.
Well, knowing you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It don't take much for me.
No. M's the, here's a branch break and we're on the car going home. Now, here's something that I think gets undersold in a lot of coverage. The sounds that it makes. Multiple witnesses independently of each other describe hearing this high-pitched, sustained cry or screaming coming across the lake at night. It's not just once. It's repeatedly doing it. And others describe it as kind of a mix between a howling and like a bleh.
Okay, so a goat. Literally a goat.
Yeah, like a goat. Which is actually part of where the name came from. Because the press started calling it, alongside the Lake Worth Monster, the Goat Man. And look, the sounds might actually be the creepiest part of the whole thing. To me, because people were reporting them separately from the visual sightings. Like, you didn't have to see it to know something was out there.
Yeah, weird scream across the lake at night is going to ruin anyone's evening.
Mm-hmm. Completely. And the last thing on the physical description, behaviorally, witnesses said it was fast and agile. It could move through the woods quickly. It could climb. It could jump. And? It's strong. Very, very strong. But I'm going to save exactly what that means for the next part of the story. We're going to get there. So, here's the thing about the Lake Worth Monster that sets it apart from a lot of cryptid cases. There's no ancient folklore here, no old legends passed down through generations, no indigenous warning about the creature in the woods. This thing just, poof, appeared.
You mean it just appeared? Things just don't appear.
I mean, one summer it wasn't a story, and then suddenly, boom, everywhere. It erupted into public consciousness almost overnight, driven almost entirely by eyewitness reports, clustered within a really short window of time. And it all starts with one specific night.
Please do tell. I'm on the edge of my seat here.
So in July 9th of 1969, it's nighttime. You have three couples, so there's six people, parked near an area called Greer Island on Lake Worth. They're just hanging out. It's summer in Texas, so it's hot. You go to the lake at night. You know, we wouldn't know how that is because I don't think we have lakes near us. We have the Delaware River.
Yeah.
And we're definitely not going near that at nighttime.
Surely not.
So.
But it sounds like, for most accounts, normal.
All you folks who have that know what we're talking about.
Seems normal.
But then, one of the men there, a guy named Jack Harris, starts hearing something coming from the dark. He described it as a squalling, kind of like a howling. And then this sound, he said, was almost human, but not quite. Like something was in distress, but also something that didn't have a human throat that was making it.
Okay, well, that description, I hated that.
Well, it's going to get worse. Because right after the sound, the figure appears.
Of course it does.
It's large, upright, 7 feet, covered in fur, and what witnesses called scales. Just standing there, looking at them. According to the people present, it wasn't just standing passively. It had like an aggressive stance. It had this presence. And then the strong thing I mentioned. This creature reaches down, picks up a spare tire, like we're full spare tire, rim and all, and just throws it about 500 feet towards their vehicles.
I'm sorry?
500 feet.
A whole tire.
One whole tire.
Okay. Well, that's like...
pretty much longer than a football field. And before you get into it, yes, there was physical evidence. When the police arrived, they found a deep gash running along the side of one of the cars, which is part of why this report got taken seriously.
I was actually thinking to myself, what about this specific encounter made all these people take them seriously? You think like a bunch of people.
Yeah, you'd think just because, oh, they threw a tire at me.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, right, I was going to, okay. Where's your proof?
It's Texas. They have guns.
It's a rough sell.
Assuming. Well, actually, the police admitted they'd been getting calls about something strange in that area for weeks leading up to this. But they'd been writing them all off as pranks.
And then that damn tire.
That damn tire. Suddenly, now it's harder to ignore. You've got multiple witnesses, consistent descriptions, a damaged vehicle, and law enforcement shifting from, yeah, sure, buddy, to actually opening up an investigation.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant shift.
It is. And then local papers, specifically the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, picked it up almost immediately. And they ran with both names, the Lake Worth Monster and the Goat Man. And I want to be clear, Goat Man wasn't something the journalists invented. It came directly from what witnesses were describing. The goat-like face, the sounds, the horns, the press just ran with it because they could.
Well, of course they did. Goat Man's a great headline.
I mean, yeah, it really is. And here's where it gets a little weird. And I mean wild in a very specific and very Texan way.
I'm ready.
The coverage triggers an immediate public reaction. And I mean immediate. Within days, not weeks, days. People start driving out to Lake Worth at night in large numbers.
To see the monster, duh.
Yep, to see a monster. Some of them are just curious. Some of them are treating it like a social event. And some of them...
please.
Arriving in truckloads, armed.
Armed, of course.
Yep, with guns, they're going to hunt the goat man.
That's Texas.
It is
Texas. It's so Texas.
Yep. And then there's this guy named Rick Pratt, who was associated with the Greer Island Nature Center at this time, and he later described the whole scene as chaotic. Informal, people showing up with guns and alcohol, gathering in groups, treating the whole thing like a nighttime event.
So it's like half a monster hunt, half tailgate.
Pretty much. Law enforcement had to assign officers just to manage the traffic and crowds around the most active sighting locations.
Oh, so it got out of hand quickly.
Oh, we're just getting started. Because the very next night, July 10th, another large group gathers near a clearing by the lake, a dumping ground area. And this time, among the crowd, you have actual sheriff's deputies present. And while everyone's gathered there, a figure appears on a nearby bluff. Upright, the aggressive posture, and in front of the crowd and the deputies, it threw another tire.
What's its obsession with tires?
I have no idea, but it apparently has this never-ending store of tires.
It's actually very funny.
The crowd, the armed Texans who specifically came to hunt this thing,
ran.
They scattered.
Did they all run?
Gone. Including those deputies.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, I would too run, but I don't think I would be there. Period. But
no. You would definitely not be there.
But yeah, no, if a big monster thing, like 7-foot monster, throws a tire at me, yeah, I'm leaving.
Yeah, I mean, if you were there long enough to see the monster.
Yeah.
Definitely. You'd be out. But you'd do one of those, yeah, it's a great idea. And then a time to come, you'd be like, it's not that great of an idea.
A terrible idea.
Yeah. I got, like, I'm going to go get food or something. So, I mean, running, it's completely reasonable. And honestly, the fact that the trained law enforcement officer scattered along with everyone else tells you something about the atmosphere out there. Whatever the people were seeing or thought they were seeing, it was enough.
Okay, so within 2 nights, you have a creature sighting, a damaged car, 2 tire-throwing incidents, an armed public mob, and deputies just fleeing into the night.
That's an accurate summary of the first 48 hours of the Lake Worth Monster.
This is very, very Texas. Mm. I feel like it's just going to keep getting weirder.
Oh, it's going to get weirder.
Okay.
So after the first 2 nights, the story doesn't just slow down. It expands. We've got more people out there, more reports coming in. The whole thing starts taking on a life of its own. But before we get into what happened next, I want to introduce you to someone who becomes really important to this story's legacy.
Okay. Who are we meeting?
It's a 9-year-old boy.
9-year-old boy.
His name is Craig Woolheater. It's the summer of 1969. He's 9 years old. Already, you know, boy, obsessed with monsters, dinosaurs, UFO, the classic cryptid kid origin story.
He's built for this.
He's absolutely built for this. And he's trying to follow the Lake Worth monster story through the newspaper coverage, clipping articles, and saving them in a scrapbook.
That's actually very sweet. 9-year-old Craig with his little scrapbook.
Right? Just little guy doing what he can to follow the story. But what makes it interesting is this specific summer becomes a formative moment for him. It sticks with him into adulthood. And years later, while driving through Louisiana, he has his own encounter. He says he saw a large, upright, primate-looking figure briefly lit up by his headlights on the side of the road.
Yeah, that's genuinely terrifying.
Oh, it rewired him. Because in 99, he founded the Texas Bigfoot Research Center.
From 9-year-old scrapbook kid to founding the Texas Bigfoot Research Center, that's a full circle arc.
Yeah, and his position on the Lake Worth Monster is that it fits into the broader pattern of sightings across the United States. That what people are seeing is an undiscovered primate species capable of moving between 2 suitable habitats.
So basically Bigfoot adjacent.
Yeah, pretty much. When you look at the physical descriptions, the height, the build, the movement, it's not completely an unreasonable framework.
I mean, it's more reasonable than a goat monster, if we're being honest.
Slightly more zoologically plausible, yes. So, meanwhile, back at the lake, the sightings are just, they just keep coming through. All through July. Witnesses are just describing environmental disturbances. There's large splashes in the water, heavy movement through the brush, and footprints. Some witnesses claim the prints, they didn't match any known animal in the area.
Okay, but to be fair, at this point you've got how many people coming to see this animal every night? How much of that is like actually the creature, and how much of that is just some Bob from Fort Worth just tripping over a bush?
I mean, it's completely legitimate. That's a quite good question. And honestly, it probably accounts for a decent percentage of it. But here's the thing. Some of these reports come from people with no known connection to each other. No apparent reason to fabricate, and no knowledge of the other's accounts.
Okay, so it's not all Bob.
And then in mid-July, something happens that takes the story to another level entirely. A local man named Alan Plaster is out near the lake, and he captures a photograph.
Here we go.
The image shows, at a distance, a light-colored upright figure. It's indistinct. It's grainy. It's not going to win the photography award for anything.
as most cryptid photos, I feel, tend to be.
As they always are. There seems to be a rule. But it gets published in the local media, and suddenly, now you got a visual, which changes everything in the terms of the public interest.
Well, yeah, because now it's not just people's word for it. You've got a picture.
Right. Now there's something to point to. Even if you're pointing at it's basically a smudge.
It's still a significant smudge.
A historically important smudge. And here's the kicker. Alan Plaster himself later expressed doubt about what he photographed. Said it may have been staged. So, the one piece of visual evidence associated with the case comes with a disclaimer from the guy who took it.
I mean, I guess it's very honest of him, but it doesn't really help us any.
The only thing I can see why he would do something like that is because maybe it was, like, tormenting him. Yeah. And, like, he's getting all this, like, oh, you staged it, you this. And yeah. Maybe he's getting, like, criticism where he's just, like, it's staged.
Right, he's like, all right, fine.
Or the monster started haunting him. Well, who knows? But it does remain the only visual artifact from the whole summer, and it is essentially uncertified by its own photographer.
Incredible. So we have a blurry, maybe, staged photo, a scrapbook kid turned Bigfoot researcher, and a whole lot of crowd noise. Is there any actual alternative explanation for any of this?
Oh, there's an explanation, and it's something.
Why'd you pause like that?
Because I need a moment to appreciate it before I told you. So, the Fort Worth police investigator, Dale Hines, he points to a facility near the lake called the New Liberty Mission Rehabilitation Center.
Okay.
Which was formerly known in the area as...
As what?
The Goat Farm.
The Goat Farm.
Because the residents raised...
Goats.
Yep. So according to Hines, there was a resident at this facility, a man locally known as Foots Fowler.
Foots?
Foots Fowler.
Okay. His name was Foots Fowler.
Hey, we're just relaying
actually,
the info out.
I don't judge.
Yep. So he's described as unusually tall, with very distinctive physical features. And according to this account, Foots Fowler would leave the facility at night.
No, I'm not doing this.
Cover himself in goat skins.
Mm-mm.
And intentionally go into wooded areas around the lake to frighten people.
Surely not. Surely not Mr. Foot is the goat man.
Allegedly. Allegedly, Foots Fowler was the goat man.
So a tall man named Foots from a place called the Goat Farm wearing goat skins.
In the woods at night on purpose.
So it's either the most obvious solution to a mystery I've literally ever heard in my life, or the universe is just simply laughing at everybody.
It really kind of does feel like the universe committed to it a bit.
Well, does it hold up? Like, does Foots explain everything?
That's the honest answer. Not entirely.
Of course not.
The Foots Fowler theory, if accurate, probably accounts for some of the encounters, particularly close range ones. A tall man in goat skins in low light at night could absolutely explain a lot of what people described.
Yeah, especially to people who were already primed to seeing a monster.
Exactly. But it doesn't cleanly account for all of it. The reports came from different areas around the lake. Some of the environmental disturbances, the splashes, the movement through the brush, the footprints, they don't map neatly onto one guy in a costume doing a bit.
Slowfoots may have contributed to the legend without being the entire legend.
He could be the Goatman's, like, Robin.
He's a distant cousin of the Goatman.
Yeah, he's like...
He's a distant relative.
He might be, like, twice removed.
You know.
Who knows?
On his dad's side.
Yeah. It's kind of the most accurate way to put it. He may have been one integrated into the... into a very chaotic summer soup.
Chaotic summer soup. That's... I like it.
If we stick with it, it could be t-shirt.
It works.
By the end of July, the sightings kind of like tapered off. Crowds got bored, so they thinned. The news cycle moves on. But the story doesn't go away.
They never fade away. We're still talking about it.
Of course we are. That's what we do.
Well, yeah, that's our job.
We pull files off of our shelf and we read them.
Anyway.
So, what happens next is actually really interesting because it stopped being a news story and starts kind of being something else entirely.
Well, what does it become?
Well, you're going to have to wait for our next chapter.
I'm over this. Wait.
Stay haunted and stay weird. I'm just kidding.
See you next time.
So here's what I found genuinely fascinating about the Lake Worth Monster. Most of the cryptid stories follow a pretty predictable arc. Sightings happen. People get scared. Investigations go nowhere. The story fades out. That's it.
The cryptid retirement plan.
Pretty much. It just kind of quietly... shuffle off into the woods and become a Wikipedia footnote. But the Lake Worth Monster does something different. It doesn't fade. Kind of transforms.
Into what?
Into a full-blown piece of Texas identity. But we'll get there because, that's what we're doing now. First, we're going to talk about how the story spread beyond Fort Worth. Because that part is kind of interesting.
All right. Take me through it.
So, the Fort Worth Star Telegram was really the engine of this whole thing from the beginning. Early coverage focused on witness accounts, the police statements, the sightings. Straightforward reporting. But as the story kept going, the coverage itself became part of the story. Because the more they printed, the more people showed up at the lake. And the more people showed up, the more reports came in.
So it just fed itself.
It was like a machine. And then in 1969, the same year as the sightings, a woman named Sally Ann Clark self-published a book called The Lake Worth Monster of Greer Island, Fort Worth, Texas.
Same year? Works quick.
Remarkably fast. I should say, remarkably quick. She compiled her version of the events and her personal experiences with the whole situation. And look, it helped spread the story beyond just newspaper readers. It gave the legend a physical artifact, something you can hold.
But...
It has since been pretty widely regarded as containing exaggerated or fictionalized elements.
Ah.
Which, and I say, no judgment, is kind of inevitable when you're writing about something this chaotic this quickly. The story was actively evolving when she kind of was writing it.
So she was... essentially writing fan fiction about something that was still actively happening.
Yeah. And she's not alone because the Lake Worth Monster has inspired a whole shelf of books over the years. Lyle Blackburn, who's a pretty well-respected name in cryptozoology circles, wrote about it in context of Texas cryptids broadly, helping place it within wider American tradition of sightings.
So it gets legitimized within its own world.
within its own world, yes. And then there's the book called The Lake Worth Monster, Telling His Side of the Story by Bobby F. Brooks, which just takes a full fictional swing at it. It fully leans into the creative potential of the legend.
I respect that, honestly. At some point, you gotta commit.
Commit to the bit. And it also shows up in collections like Weird Texas, which is exactly what it sounds like. A roundup of the strange and unexplained from across the state, which honestly feels like a natural home for it.
The Lake Worth Monster absolutely belongs in a book called Weird Texas.
I mean, I love those weird books. I'm pretty sure they have one of every state.
I love it.
But it was pretty much born for the book. So then you get books, people with sightings, you know, we kind of evolve. Now we got TV. There's a show called Monsters and Mysteries in America, which I do tend to watch. They did an episode called Texas Terror, and it featured reenactments and interviews about the Lake Worth sightings.
Reenactments. So somebody had to play Fritz Fowler.
Someone had to put the goat skins on for television.
I truly hope that that person got paid well.
I'd hope so. Ooh. Could you imagine if they were real, like, goat skins? They weren't, like, the, like, fake ones?
Ew. Like, yeah.
That kind of, like, just dawned on me when we were reading that.
Yeah, I hope they're getting paid well.
So researchers like Lyle Blackburn have appeared in various media segments discussing the case, which keeps it in circulation for audiences who might never have heard of Fort Worth, let alone Lake Worth.
So it goes from local newspaper story to books to television. It is certainly a media journey.
It's a full arc there. And alongside all of that skepticism, it keeps developing too, which I think is worth acknowledging because it's part of the story. Alan Plaster, the photographer, casting doubt on his own photo, the Fritz Fowler theory, and a broader sense among some researchers that at least portions of the witnesses' accounts, particularly at the height of the frenzy, were deliberate pranks.
I mean, when you have hundreds of people going to a lake at night with alcohol and guns, someone's absolutely going to start messing with people.
I'm actually pretty shocked nobody, like, got shot.
Seriously.
Like, there's not, like, a...
Right, like, there wasn't, like, an incident or something.
This. Yeah, an incident. Yeah. There you go. Better way to put it.
True.
I mean, the tire-throwing incident in particular have been partially attributed to people in a crowd deliberately trying to frighten others once the story was already rolling.
So potentially some of the evidence for the monster was created by people who came to find the monster.
Which is kind of funny and is also kind of philosophically interesting if you think about it too hard.
I'm choosing not to think about it too hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think about things hard, so.
Yeah, and I would not want to live a second in your brain.
I wouldn't want anybody to live a second in my brain. So by the 1980s, the active sightings have largely stopped, and this is where the transformation really happens, because without ongoing incidents, the community can't really treat it as a threat anymore. So instead, they start treating it as theirs.
That's kind of nice, actually.
It is. Local businesses start incorporating the Lake Worth Monster into their branding, their advertising, and it becomes this informal mascot for the area. The thing that once had people grabbing their guns and heading to the lake at night becomes a regional symbol.
From monster to mascot. What a glow up.
It's a genuine one. And it culminates beautifully in 2009, the 40th anniversary of the sightings. And to mark the occasion, the Fort Worth Nature Center and Refuge hosted the first ever Lake Worth Monster Festival.
They did not throw it a party.
Oh, they threw it a party. Well, not a party. They threw it a whole festival to celebrate the anniversary of the summer. The 7-foot goat man threw tires at people. Yeah, it's community events, tourism, people coming together to celebrate this completely chaotic chapter of their local history. And it works. It draws people in. It keeps the story alive. Pretty much in the best possible way it could.
You know what I think is actually beautiful about that, though? Like, genuinely, the thing that terrified people, that sent literal deputies running into the dark, becomes the thing that they gather around and throw a festival and party for voluntarily with presumably fewer guns, I hope.
It's Texas.
It is Texas.
I think it says something real about how communities process their strange histories. It stops being about whether the monster was real and starts being about what that summer meant. The shared experience of it. The wildness of it.
The chaotic summer soup of it all.
The chaotic summer soup. Exactly. And honestly, whether it was an unknown creature, whether it was Foots Fowler and goat skins, whether it was Bigfoot passing through Texas, or whether it was just a really exceptional summer of mass hysteria and pranks, something happened at Lake Worth in 1969. People saw enough things that it couldn't be ignored. And 50 plus years later, we're still talking about it.
And Craig Wolheater's scrapbook started it all for him.
9-year-old, with his newspaper clippings, becomes an absolute legend.
So where do you land on it, personally? Real or not real?
I land in the same spot I land on pretty much all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Why can't it be out there?
Right, why not?
Whether it's kind of like one thing or was one thing and then became several things, or, you know, the guy named Foots puts ghost goat costume on and you know, extends the legend or whatever.
I
think that night in the summer of 69, which is
summer
in a song.
You know what? Every single time you said it, I wanted to say it, but you spoke too fast after that, so I didn't want to cut you off every time.
That was like the point where I feel like I just like timed it up.
Yeah, too.
Perfect. It had something to it that people just couldn't explain. I find it interesting that there isn't anything that there was something that happened that they couldn't explain. And to me, that intrigues me.
Yes.
It's kind of what happens with most cryptids. They can't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't explain it, you know, but I think there's something out there.
I would agree.
What we do know, though, is the Lake Worth Monster case shows how quickly a series of eyewitness reports can move beyond isolated incidents and become part of a broader narrative. In this case, local reporting, repeated accounts, and public participation, they all contributed to the story's longevity. And at the center of it are the original witnesses, individuals who reported encounters that could not easily be explained. Around those accounts, other elements developed: media coverage, possible hoaxes, alternative explanations, and later reinterpretations through books, television, and local events. No physical evidence has ever been verified, and no single explanation accounts for all reports. As a result, the Lake Worth Monster remains unresolved, not confirmed, nor fully explained. Today it exists both as a historical event tied to the summer of 69, and as an ongoing piece of regional folklore in Fort Worth. As always, we have to give a shout out to Sam, who wrote this episode. Go over and check out her podcast, Scare Me Sam, where she reviews horror, thriller, and dark fantasy books. If you found this episode interesting, please share it with some friends, family, your local cryptid, whatever. don't forget to go follow the Ominous Archives on all of our social medias. shoot us an email, theominousarchives.com. We love hearing from you guys. I think that's all. I don't think I got anything else.
I think that's it.
I definitely need to get more water. But, maybe even go to bed.
Maybe.
We're three for three?
Mm.
3 for 5? Something like that. I don't know.
Something or other.
We've been recording late at night, so. With all that being said, as always, stay weird and stay haunted. See ya.
See ya.